welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McClower. We have a new engineer training tonight, and Don also is helping him out. He's the manager of the station. So, I don't know his name, but hello. I'll say hello to our new trainee. And tonight's show, first of all, obviously, we're here to talk about metaphysics and spirituality and science and deal with some questions that usually people don't find easy answers to. That's what the show really is all about, I would say. And tonight I thought we'd talk about the grace of God and the light at the end of the tunnel, kind of a play on words a little bit, depending upon how you look at that. And I've covered some elements of this subject within the last month or so, but tonight's going to be a bit different because I really didn't go into some of the things that I wanted to, so I said, you know, what the heck, I'll do another show that's related to that, and both a different bent. So it'll be our show tonight to kind of go deeper into some things. And as usual, I want to define what I mean at the beginning so that we can have kind of a common understanding. When I say the grace of God, what I'm talking about is the ability for God to choose to forgive and ignore the illusion and selfishness of a human being during the times that the human being specifically is incarnated in the more difficult areas of life and the dimensions of life. So, and this is within the realm of karma. A lot of people say, well, how could God do that if there's such a thing as karma? Well, God can do that because God is God, first of all. But the other part about it is that God can do that because the human has made a sacrifice, even though it's mostly subconscious to the human being, at least during the first parts of their existence in, like, the physical and sometimes in the astral world. And the sacrifice is that they have chosen to live in places that they're going to become illusion because of the density of energy and the lack of ability to think well enough to overcome the forces that energy has developed itself into. And it forces one energy against another. So you have these conflicting energies that produce forces. And so we live in a forceful existence here in the physical world, one in which the ability to sense is limited by the damage of the forces to the senses that we use, and that causes us to become illusioned. Illusioned means that the light of God, or spirit, thought of God, light, is not readily apparent to us. And by not being apparent to us, we see something different and respond and react to that something different. As an example, the light of God could be to help someone you either know or don't know to help other people. You help them to help others. That's a great thing to do. But let's say that you're illusioned, and instead you decide that wouldn't it be nice if instead of spending your time wasting your time in your mind helping them, that you just get them to do something that they don't want to do necessarily for you by some manipulative fashion. And you say, well, that didn't feel so bad. Maybe I can do that instead. You know? Well, that's a state of illusion. And the other state is a state of enlightenment or some increased level of light. And that's a great thing. Now, the grace of God is the forgiveness of that particular action because of the great sacrifice made to even be in such a hostile environment as especially the physical world. And so people do terribly selfish, mean, horrible things to other people. Yeah, they do. And This is part of the problem that we live in a world where people are constantly doing these terrible things to themselves, to other people, and also to maybe animals, or who knows. I mean, it doesn't have to stop with just people. And what do I mean by the light at the end of the tunnel? Well, light, again, is the thought of God. Light is literally the thought of God. When there is light, then God's thought is clear, and it is being usually used as a guide for any kind of interaction that is taking place. Okay, the light at the end of the tunnel in this particular circumstance is referring kind of allegorically to the fact that when, first of all, we die from the physical world, we move through a tunnel that has light in it, and the light at the end of it is where we end up, and where we end up is almost always a place where we are more conscious by the grace of God. In other words, we've gained something by moving on because we've lost the senses that have become contaminated and destroyed through illusion that we've used so selfishly. We've lost the body associated with it, and we now have senses that are in much better shape. They have been used and abused at times themselves, but because most of the time our consciousness was not focused through them, they're still in pretty good shape, and they actually take a bump up because we're in a place now where we can think much more easily, and the forces around us are so much less. That's what happens when you go on to the astral plane. So this is all tied together. You can see the light at the end of the tunnel is really tied together. That's one of the allegorical issues about the light at the end of the tunnel. Another way to look at the light at the end of the tunnel is that no matter how bad we have made things, the grace of God is at the end of a long, drudging tunnel that we have built for ourselves, but can be overcome through God's grace. And this grace isn't without having been earned. It's just that we are unaware of the earning of it coming from a state of being a soul and in a state of losing our senses where we're unrecognizing that. We can't recognize it because you lose the sense of how much sense you have faster than you lose the sense itself. So you can never tell that you've really become soul illusion. And this is part of how the meaning of that second part could be interpreted. So it kind of has a multiple ways of understanding this whole phrase. Okay, tonight's show, though, I want to focus on the question of consciousness itself and why consciousness does not ever die. It's important because in my experiences, I've had some very recently, actually, a friend who had a different perspective on this. But the meaning to life, meaning of life, and also the ability to live relatively fearless, especially of death, comes from the understanding that consciousness is immortal. It goes on. Now, it has changes to it as it moves on, and it doesn't remain in a state in which it may be compressed as much as and reduced as much as it is while we're physically alive. That's good. That's good, and the grace of God is part of that. If consciousness were to stop at the time of death, it would create a lot of problems in terms of all of the things that we consider to be God's meaning, purpose, etc. The conflicts would be that, first of all, suffering comes from loss of consciousness, not from pain per se. And suffering is a state in which the more consciousness a person loses, the greater, and they still have some awareness of it, the greater the level of suffering. If we conclude that consciousness fails, it ceases to exist at death, then prior to death, we live the projection of that moment of death in which we will no longer exist, and we suffer for that for the entire lifetime. Now you can say, oh, well, what's so bad about that? You know, I just repress that, you know. Well, you can repress it and deny it. However, in real terms, there is no such thing as denying on at least the personality or subconscious level. You can't deny things subconsciously. You can deny them consciously, of course. And once you start denying your belief that your consciousness will cease to exist at death, you start building up inordinate levels of anxiety and fear. And fear is the real enemy of the soul. So when people have the belief that consciousness ceases to exist at death, they have a belief that God does not exist in part. Not the God that I refer to. Their God, in some religious sense, might be real to them. Their God might be a very toxic God that seeks to have human beings face this indeterminable non-existence question and to have no answers for even the meaning of their life. Why is that? Well, if all there is to life is the one life of a human being in the physical world, that's a very small, narrow part of even the life of that human being as you go into the astral and monastic world. So now you're shutting off all this other experience. But worse than that, if there's no continuation of the consciousness, which would lead right back to the soul, by the way, and there's some interesting Jewish writers that have come to the same conclusion I'm telling you right now, but if there was no continuation of consciousness, then the meaning to the life, the meaning of the life, would dissolve away at the point where consciousness ceases. And you would have to ask yourself, well, what's it all about? And then you would have to also ask yourself, why would a God that is a loving God, in which God is a loving God, and a God that itself is superlative and super in consciousness, deny the reality of consciousness to a being who's going to suffer because it has high enough consciousness to recognize that, and who's going to feel separated from God as a result of it, and potentially will reject God. Maybe religion along with it, but in either case, reject God. Now, yes, there are some religions that actually propose what I just said, and they keep people in their religion because of a subconscious fear, which is derived from that thinking, that they try to alleviate in some way by saying, well, yes, you're going to lose, you're not going to have any consciousness, you're not going to exist anymore, but at some point you'll be reborn in some fashion and have an exalted life. So it's like nothing or everything and nothing in between, but no development of consciousness and self. Self remains static in a very strange way. This sort of thing is a means of intimidation and fear-mongering to promote a religious viewpoint that holds that particular belief, along with the means and fashions that are available to that particular religion offered to people, is the one and only one that will in some way restore consciousness or at least keep some level of it at some point in some way. Because there's a number of different scenarios to the whole operation. All of those things do not allow for the grace of God. They don't. They're absolutes. And so the grace of God goes away. Because if your consciousness goes away, God cannot grace you or can't do anything to you because you won't be there to be graced. Consciousness is what it takes to exist. So you can see how the light at the end of the tunnel becomes darkness throughout the entire tunnel till the end, which is further dark, and a system in which consciousness fails to survive physical life. Or anyway, at that matter. Obviously, there's something seriously wrong with that concept. And, I mean, I could go on with a lot of other examples why this just doesn't work. But I don't want to belabor that because I think I've pretty well convinced a lot of you that what I'm saying is most likely correct. That's what I really want. Because, again, some of you who are atheists or possibly in a certain kind of religion that thinks that consciousness does not survive death. Those folks are living the suffering, and I want to help you to not suffer and to instead find that there is grace of God and that there is a better life, even though the life we're here for right now is more important in some ways than the life we're headed for in the future. Now, why is it more important? Well, here, right now, as we live here, we are struggling almost every minute because of the forces involved. They're pretty bad right now, particularly in the world we're in, because of changes in the way energies are focused on the planet, some other issues with human beings, producing really serious forces. Okay, so we got all that going on, but then what is the recourse for us in terms of living in such a difficult place, and why is it so good for us to be able to then look back on this and say, well, this wasn't so bad because I lived there with the opportunity to create the most good that I could ever create in that relatively short lifetime while I was physically alive. I'm going to go on to a lifetime many times longer in the astral world, but the opportunities to create the most good are diminished by the fact that there's much fewer forces, much less illusion, and there's greater grace of God, which is allowing each person that goes on to the astral world to live a better life if they choose to. They may choose not to, by the way, but at least the choice is apparent and available. And so this is the concept that we need to keep in mind. We have the most opportunity to create the most good under the most difficult of circumstances right here in the physical world. We move on to less challenging, less difficult places with greater grace of God for having just lived through this life and with some ability to create virtue, light, and form while we're in these other places. But we lose the opportunity here. We don't lose consciousness of here. We lose interaction. We lose the opportunity to be in existence in this realm. That's how and what it means to not have a body, but spiritual focus, but no body any longer. You need a body to exist in the type of energy that body is made of, and with the senses that can sense in that realm. We lose that body, and we go on to the astral world, where we have a body who can do that in the astral world without as much difficulty and without as many problems. That body is also used to give us feelings, emotional feelings, while we're physically alive. So we do use it a bit, probably a few percent to maybe 5 or 6 or 7% of the time, and in the rest of the time we're using our physical senses, which dominate our life. They dominate because they're so much more intense. And intensity of energy really demands the focus of our life. It actually, like it says, you can't go and just flake out because here's the intensity right here of what it means to be alive for us at this point. To God, what does it mean? Well, God needs all 7 major dimensions with 7 subdimensions in each one of those. To become developed for life. And human life is the first kind of life that can recognize its own creator. Why is this important? What do those two things mean? Well, in terms of human beings, it's kind of an interesting, fascinating, actually, concept that human beings are here because they become the closest thing to God that lives exclusively for a while in the physical world, or mostly, we'll say, exclusively in the physical world. I don't know how you'd be mostly exclusive, but let's say, instead of exclusive, but mostly in the physical world. And this is important to realize, that animals don't. Why don't they? Well, the animal is in a kingdom, called the animal kingdom, that does not have a sense of its own creator. It senses that would do that, its heart and crown chakra, if it even has those, some animals do, some don't, does not have a sphere of consciousness connected to it. And therefore, animals cannot be conscious of the sense that the center develops and cannot be conscious of the information that the center processes. And by not having either of those, it cannot develop a consciousness of God. All right. Now, that's a big deal. So human beings are filling a big gap by being here and can do those things. If we choose to, doesn't mean we're going to, but if we choose to. So you got that. All right, so getting back to the whole point. The whole point of this is that God is seeking life more abundant. It's seeking that life, which is its means of growth, grow everywhere. But it doesn't just want any old life. It accepts that there has to be many, almost fantastic number of different levels of life in consciousness. And as life grows in consciousness at all these different levels, it can interact. It can learn ways, we'll say, of using the third part of God's mind, which is the energy realm. However, human beings are different. We can be conscious of our interactions. We can be conscious of the idea and thought that there is a creator. And by nature, we do this because we have a soul, which is so much more complex. It gives to us the ability to sense a much greater amount than any animal can. And that builds a much higher consciousness over time. All right. So, looking at this whole hodgepodge of different things I've explained, it seems as though the bottom line to this whole thing is God is seeking the growth of consciousness through the growth of life, and the critical mass of consciousness occurs in human beings. When this critical mass happens, the human being becomes conscious of God in all kinds of life, and existentially outside of life, and becomes aware and conscious that God is conscious of them. They not only love people and animals, but they learn to love God, and they also learn that God loves them. So this sort of scenario takes on a new meaning to the existence, to life. And it makes it so that we, as human beings, can make that challenging crossing from being animalistic and seeking things for oftentimes material outcomes and not seeking consciousness or love as a means of living. And then reaching the point where we develop ourselves, now this may not become in this one lifetime by any stretch, to the point where one of the incarnations, like right now, now has this overriding determination to be conscious of God in every way possible. That's a person leading a spiritual life, because God's thought matters to them, and God's thought, because they seek it, is part of them. This is what God seeks, for us to co-create with it. I've heard me say that many times. Now, it may make a little more sense after tonight's show. So we're here to do that, and what we're not here to do is to prevent ourselves or other people from doing that. And when we do, we create a lot of karma, negative karma for ourselves. And we bring about, many times, the further destruction of our own senses and, of course, significant reductions in consciousness. All right, well, I hope all this is kind of adding up. It's kind of making some sense. You know, I'm going pretty fast, I know, but there's a lot to cover in a short time, and I'm just trying to... Some of the stuff, you can re-listen to the show, or you can go ahead and read some of the stuff I've written, and you'll find it's right in there as well. All right. So, we're here because we're co-creating with God. We're given that opportunity to, and we can reject it, or we can accept it, or do a little here and there, and not so much later on or there. We have all these choices, and they are ours to make. Yes, some of the choices are produced from forces around us. But we live in such a forceful world, that isn't all that spectacular or different. It does make some small difference to people when they have all the forces and they want to change, because the forces continually obstruct. But you can get through that. We all do at times get through that and lead an exemplary life of spiritual meaning and helpfulness. All right. Then, if we're talking about the light at the end of the tunnel, that light is what we are moving towards. We are seeking to become enlightened to the level at which God's grace will be facilitated and used in the next part of our existence. Now, can we do this here? Yes. But usually it requires some level of spiritual discipline to achieve. People don't normally spontaneously take on these very difficult meanings and tasks. What they do is they usually try to avoid them, and when circumstances cannot be avoided, or when a person has truly made the change in themselves to realize what's the right thing to do, then you have a whole different arena. And new kinds of people, like living souls, start to interact and create a new existence for themselves while they are physically alive. This is a great saga, you can say. All right, so we have this great conflict, but with a big payoff to go through. How many people really do? Well, not as many as I would like. And some people are caught in the illusion of loss of self and consciousness as an eventual end of life. And those people are suffering. So I'm hopefully going to try to help those folks to not suffer so much by understanding more about what happens when we die and how we get closer to God in some respects, maybe not at all, and how this is really part of a big process that leads us into a realm in which we no longer are materially focused, but we are focused rather on a balanced state of seeking to be more conscious while gaining greater understanding, which is still consciousness, that's just another word for it, of God's needs and wants in terms of creation. And then setting ourselves into motion, being a replicator of the God that's already inside us. And you say, well, why don't we just pray to God and let God do everything? You know, it's themselves too much in trouble. And the reason for that is that God made the universe the way it is. God is the one that destroyed the universe. God wants us to take charge of it. Now, does that mean that when we take charge of it, there aren't other beings greater than we are who also have their charge, so to speak? Yes, but then we're all working as a team rather than one side tugging on the other, and it's really a no-gain situation, which is so often the case. So we do have this tremendous opportunity, which I find exciting. And it is exciting in ways that really leads to a more meaningful life. But it doesn't mean that it's going to be effective or immediate, because there are so many forces that we're dealing with. And some of the forces are promoted by pure evil. When we have to deal with these forces, we cannot have the expectation that what we think of as success is really what it's going to be. Success is based upon growing our Creator, not upon us getting what we want or having more authority or power or control. It's none of those things. So that's where the bottom line comes from. It's sort of like, well, if you're looking for the wrong reasons, then when you try to correct it with the right reasons, you end up with a conflict because it doesn't work out that way. And people today have a lot of those things going on in their lives. All right. Now, is that just an excuse to say that God must exist because God wants all these wonderful things for us, and it just isn't right? Why isn't that? What isn't right? If there's grace of God, how come God cannot grace us right here, right now? Why do we have to be dying or dead to get the grace of God? It's very unfortunate. There are rare events, we'll call them miracles, where God does give grace to people who are alive and physically kicking right here. However, most of the time, it is true that God does not give grace to people who are right here and make it that much easier for them to exist. It doesn't. Well, if that's true, then what's going on? You know, I mean, why would it take that kind of bend and everything? And the answer is fairly simple, actually. If God gave grace to most people, most of the time while we're physically alive, people would become lazy, selfish, and less willing to take a lot of very important chances. If we expect to be autonomous, but at the same time to be within the grace of God, we need to be spiritually disciplined and to attack all of the things that are going after that side of human beings, so that we can reach a state in which it's like a natural state of being enlightened. And we can reach that. We can. Provided that we do not dismiss the trials and tribulations that so often do take place in the physical world. We just realize that those trials and tribulations have a finite time and number and space connected to them. And they aren't going to be long for very long. They aren't going to be part of the world existence for very long. So we can look forward to a better time, for sure. All right. So then grace is most of the time handed out, so to speak, when we die and go on to the afterworld. What happens to the few people who get grace while they're physically alive? How does that work out? I mean, they go on and spend 10, 15 years work doing this crazy stuff with, you know, trying to prove that they're going to be superlative or whatever else. We are here because it's a very, very tough life, but one in which we are forced to be more creative than we are afraid. And the force of the creativity comes from those forces I said are so strong. in order to be creative in the sea of forces, you have to learn how to change the one force, the one energy against another, to becoming energies that work together. That's part of the creative process. This comes from changing ourselves and how we change other things around ourselves. And then we become more creative. And since we, in order to be a co-creator with God, you've got to be a creative at some point. And that's what stands in the way for most people. And you can't have the fear of death. If you're afraid of dying because consciousness is going to end in your belief system, well, then it's going to be very hard to perceive and move and challenge reality by having a life that is going to be creative when you're too afraid to do that. Wow. I hope that makes some sense. I'm going kind of faster because I'm looking at the clock, and I want to finish this section about the concepts of what we're going to be talking about in the rest of the show. I like to do that. A lot of this is kind of scientific. It's kind of metaphysical and physics as well. I could talk about the physics part. I don't know if we have much time for that, but basically the thing called the quantum constant is changed in each one of these realms and subdimensions, even of realms. And when that changes, the process of forces diminishes. Forces happen because when a quantum constant is extremely small, energy has a very narrow place that it can exist in. When the quantum constant increases, energy can exist in all kinds of places at the same time and can do all kinds of amazing things, some of them almost profound. That's because the quantum constant controls this relationship of energy to space and time. And when you change one, you change the others. You change the quantum constant, you change the relationship of energy to forces, and you change time and space. Time becomes dilated, and space becomes more multidimensional. There's more dimensionality to it. Okay, so that's enough for the physics. For you physicists out there who want to know, inquiring minds, got to know about it. Okay, well, you got it. All right. So here we have, and there's math to that. I mean, some people have asked me, well, can you do the math to prove that? Yes, I can. I can. But, I mean, it's really taken some discipline on my part because I'm really annoyed by math. Math kind of hides things. I know a lot of people think, oh, it just opens up everything because you can see it all on that formula. No, it doesn't. There's no concept in the formula. The formula just proves or disproves the concept to some level as long as you're not thinking about the mental world. Math works great up to the mental world. You go beyond the mental world, the Buddha plane, forget it. Math ain't going to be any good there. You think too, it slows you down, you think too slowly. And those who think very intuitively find math atrociously slow. They just go, oh, too slow, too slow. Okay. Back to our scenario. And we're running out of time for this segment at any rate. So let's think about this. What we've covered so far is that the grace of God has limitations based upon what God decided was going to be the method in which life grows, which is through consciousness. And God decided that there would be limitations on what kind of grace that could exist within such a terrible realm with so many forces where consciousness is continually diminished. And God decided that grace shall not be bestowed except on the greatest heroes and the ones who do amazing things because it denies us the privilege and right and, we'll say, experience to overcome our fear so that we can become more creative. God doesn't want to remove that test for us because it's much more than a test. It's a growth experience, a tremendous growth experience, and all of us are entitled to experience it at our level. And God will not take that away from us, even though it loves us so. That kind of love would be smothering of love. It would remove one of the key elements for our existence, the very basis of most or a lot of the meaning of life here in the physical world particularly, would be removed. So that's it. That's the bottom line. I hope that made some sense to you. I know we went a little fast, but the good news is you can re-listen to the show in a few days, right? And you can just say, oh, here, wow, I can re-listen to it, and now I can hear what he said the second time or a third time. And it may make more sense to you at that point. Well, listen, we're going to take a break. It'll be about 2.5 minutes. And when we come back, I'm going to talk about what this all means in terms of more practical living. We're going to move a little away from the science and the definitions and all the math and all that other stuff. We're going to talk about the practical side of this metaphysical issue. We'll be back in about 2.5 minutes from right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. MacFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
Well, we're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. The new fellow's name is Eric, and Eric is he's fiddling with all the controls and everything. He's trying to figure out how to do all the stuff that has to be done to put me on and take me off the air and all that other stuff. So let's get back now to this question of the grace of God and the light at the end of the tunnel, so to speak. There's a major practical side to everything that I described in the first segment. Now, the first segment, of course, was obviously theoretical. There was a lot of stuff in there. There were concepts that were kind of big, and But when we look at this in terms of how we live our lives, I think you're going to see that most people are living their lives in very opposite, in wrong ways. That's their problem. And I'm here to kind of, knock on the door and say, hello, hello. There's other things you can be doing besides what you're choosing to do, because what you're choosing to do is going down this kind of opposite path of increasing forces and reducing consciousness, while at the same time you're increasing your fear of life and fear of death particularly, and being less and less creative. Now, this is the big deal. And so how do you know how much you're doing this, since, as I said in the first segment, most people's awareness of their loss of sense falls faster than the sense does itself. So the more illusions you are, the more you're going to become, because you're not going to know that you're illusion. I mean, truly, there's some truth to all of this. I said most people. Now, you can change that through spiritually disciplining yourself, but it's not so easy to do. At any rate, okay, what other method can we use if we don't have a direct sense? Not direct, we can't sense it. Most of the time, we can't directly sense when we're in illusion. The answer is the creative thing. You can change, look at how much in each day you are being creative or not being creative. And creation in the sense that I'm talking about is creation of God, therefore it has to be creation that brings more light into yourself and the world in some way. If you're doing that, then you'll notice it, and you can then say, okay, I can now use creation or creativity as my yardstick, provided it builds more light in the world. Now, if you create a terrible mess and you're nothing but a monstrous stealer of other people's energy and time and destruction of things, well, then it's not probably going to go too well for you to be creative in that way. That's creative in darkness. And if you're creative in darkness, it's the same results in the long run as though you weren't creative at all in terms of light. But there is the negative side. When you're creative of darkness, you have an accumulation of what's called negative karma, which will make it even more difficult in the future, because the forces will increase by as much as 10 or even dozens of times more. And you increase the forces by that much in a world where things are very forceful already, you can see how serious a problem this world can become. All right, creativity. That's such a big deal, but how do we measure that? Can we sense how creative we are being? Yes, that's the good news. That sense doesn't diminish like the sense of illusion does. So we can still see how creative we are. We could still be in illusion about that if we are badly illusioned in other ways also. But at least if you're not too badly illusioned, you've got a crack at it. You've got a reasonable yardstick to determine to what extent are you living a life in which your creation of light, hopefully, is greater by a substantial margin than your fear of death. Because remember, death is the fear of loss completely of consciousness. And even a belief in some theory of death in which you believe you're partially going to lose consciousness is terrifying. Truly. You can do your own guided, like, fantasies about these scenarios of dying, and you can see what I'm talking about. If you try it, you will come to the realization that the way to get over the fear of death, which we covered in earlier shows I talked about, is really about being aware of your creativity and being aware that this fear of death is a crucial element in preventing you from living a godly existence. Remember, you find God, you live through and in God, when you create more light. Let me say that one more time. When you create more light in everything around you, which is called living a virtuous life, virtue is light in form. So when you do that, you simultaneously find more of God in yourself and more of yourself in God. You got that? Okay. So the creation principle here is a bottom line kind of thing. And for a lot of people, it's a threatening element. Why? Why would this show be threatening to them? Why would any of this be threatening? Well, because they may have an inkling of the truth of what I'm saying, but not enough to overcome the illusion, which is the fear, of doing anything that is creative. Because when a person is seeking to live a life without fear, they do so by reducing their creativity, which causes them to lose consciousness. And what does loss of consciousness produce? Suffering. Which is like living out the end of their life ahead of time, over and over again. And the end of their life, to them, is this complete cessation of consciousness. So I hope that makes some sense to you. There's a practical side to all of this, you see, that you need to be creative so that you can live more of God while you're here. And you can create more of that life for all other beings that you can serve and who co-serve with you. This is a wondrous, wondrous formula. And God created it, in my opinion. I mean, God didn't send it to me in an envelope and say, oh, here, then say it today on the radio. This is something that I've come to as a conclusion based upon a lot of experiments, a lot of experiences, and trying to, in some cases, to do the opposite to see the effects, etc. So we're talking about really decades of challenging the ideas to see how true they are. Now, does that mean that I'm right about everything? I don't believe I'm right about everything. I don't. And I don't want people to trust that I am. I want them to go through some of the similar experiments with some help, because I can help, and come to their own conclusions. You see, part of that experience is also creation, because each person is going to do it in some different way. If they just mimicked or copied me, there wouldn't be the level of creativity. There may be none. And then the whole thing becomes a charade. And the results are that it would be absolutely meaningless in the long run. I mean, there might be little pieces of meaning here and there if you copy someone or something. But in the long run, when you put it all together, the creation is missing, so you end up with a big fat goose egg for the meaning. Even the little pieces you have will slip away into the darkness and away from the light. Okay, so you don't want to have a system of mimicking, repetition. You don't want to have people telling you and ruling you of how to live and what to live, etc. Especially a government, by the way, that does that. Because it is the dark side. It destroys creativity and it increases fear. Fearful people aren't even, if they're very fearful, aren't even close to their soul. They're not even near their soul. So they're almost anti-soul in their behaviors. They do a lot of bad things. Governments that take it on to themselves to remove the creativity of people, even though there's a little creativity, you can make a mistake and you can lose a lot of things. Well, that's too bad. You just let people make those mistakes. So we want to have the opportunity to be creative, and we should fight for it at all times. When others try to stand in our way in doing that, or in the way of others that are trying to, we should be extremely adamant that freedom is the first part of God's thought is freedom. Even before consciousness. Freedom comes before consciousness. Freedom is the first part of God's mind. The second part of God's mind, and its thought, its spirit, is love and consciousness. The two go hand in hand. There's no question about that. However, freedom still comes first. If you're not free, you can't be creative. You see? Bad news, then, for those folks that live in places where creation is limited or almost non-existent, because those people will suffer grand fears related to all, eventually to death, and they will lose consciousness as they live as much as they will gain it. They will end up on their deathbed, terrified, not knowing what to expect, no matter what was told to them. Oftentimes, the governments that support this are atheistic, because anyone that supports a true spiritual view, intuitively, if not logically, because tonight shows more logic, knows that to deny creativity and to deny freedom, therefore, to people is ungodly and leads to an aberration of what God is. Wow. Okay. So then how, if we, again, putting this in practical terms, how do we deal with situations where others are using high levels of different kinds of forces to prevent us from being creative and therefore free, and they do so at levels that surpass our ability to move the forces in various different directions to lessen the force? We've got to move the energies in ways to change them, but lessen the force. And some people do reach a kind of limit on that. It's almost like if you have an army around you, all got their guns pointed at you, and if you even don't do exactly what they said, they're going to shoot you or beat you up or do something like that, then the real question becomes, how do you defeat that? How do you deal with that? Because you're inundated with force with no reasonable way to overcome it. Now, we have these kinds of situations all the time. And people could even claim, well, my boss does that. Well, you can kind of quit your job. I mean, you do have that option. There are times when some things you can't quit happen, and that becomes a much more difficult issue. But then how do you deal with this? Well, part of the creativity that I'm talking about, the light in that is connected to the creativity, is to find ways of changing. And I mean seriously changing. I'm not talking about little hits and bits and pieces of this and that. But changing the force that is being applied to you without necessarily fighting it in every sense of the word. And you could say, well, how in the heck can you do that? Well, first of all, the forces almost invariably come from other people. Most of the time they come from other people. You can reverse the force that they're trying to put onto you if you have enough resources to do so. The resources might be money or time, because money is compressed time and energy. And it might also involve a gathering together in groups where, as a collective, they're stronger against a very ruthless other group, which might be the government or some legal authority or whoever, who is attempting to curtail the creation, curtail the choices, reduce or limit the will of God, because freedom will no longer be tolerated, will no longer be used. How do you get over freedom? If you live, let's say you live in Iran, okay. 40% of Iran is okay with there being a complete dictator and everything, but 60% of Iran, these are not my statistics, they come from another source, 60% of Iran are people who, like us, most of us, want freedom and want to be creative. So how would we help those folks? Well, the first thing, yes, I mean, I'm just giving you an example. This is an example how you can do this on a worldwide basis. Is they still do get the internet there. So is to start helping people to become more creative in ways that also are more giving at the same time, or virtuous creation, we'll call it. And you can do this over the internet, gratis. It would be like free courses on it, we'll say. And help people to gain new philosophical, spiritual, and other ways of understanding the true dictatorship and tyranny that they are presently under. Most of them have a pretty good idea of it or not. And then one to 200,000 people who are these thugs, who are part of, quote-unquote, their military establishment, live mostly around the cities, and they run around on motorcycles with like baseball bats and terrible other kinds of weapons. And some of them are actually armed with guns. And they harm people if they try to get out and protest, or they harm people who are against the status quo. And so this is where you want to defeat. You want the people there to work internally on defeating those folks. While maybe, unfortunately, it looks like another country, Israel, is going to take out a significant portion of their capability to produce a nuclear weapon. And while they're at it, it may not be too bad to take out the clerics and the mullahs and the Ahmadinejad and his like, and they're all together, dictators, one big dictatorship. Wouldn't be too bad of an idea to get rid of some of them folks as well, because although it is wrong to murder the innocent or even the untried and the, a person who denies culpability to some extent, it's okay to use force once you've determined that someone is evil and is exercising on the relatively innocent and the good. That's what's happening in Iran, and it's happening in Iraq because Iran sponsors it, and it's happening in Syria and Lebanon, it's happening in Palestine, and on and on. And to some extent, they're doing their deeds also in other Muslim countries, especially like Egypt. So this is what they're doing. They're promoting this. That's the nuclear promotion. And we have a right to stop evil. Now, you can't stop evil by just confining it, because over time it will gain the impetus, gain the force necessary to change what you've done and to convince others that you're the bad guy. The best way to deal with evil is to face it square on, to expose it, and destroy the physicality in this dimension of what it lives on. If you destroy what it lives on, it dies. So the physicality is what it lives on. These people I mentioned just a minute or two ago are multi-billionaires. They have bank accounts filled with cash and other rare and valuable things, to the tune of $50 to $100 billion. For the whole group of them. And what we should do, what the United States should do, unilaterally, in my opinion, despite what Leon Panetta says, we should not be looking for partners in the international community and asking for their permission to do these sorts of things, because if we did that in prior times, we would have Holocaust after Holocaust after Holocaust. The Soviet Union would still exist, too. All right, so. And so would all the Soviet satellite states, Poland to the Czech Republic, which was Czechoslovakia, and the whole thing. They'll all be back. All right. So, if we're going to achieve this sort of thing, then we've got to be much more creative. And one of the ways to be creative is to, in my opinion, unilaterally freeze most, if not all, of these people's assets, because when they don't have money, they don't have much power. What do they use their money for? For weapons, for control, for authority, and for a list of all kinds of subversive activities against the people of the land and other places. So, including all the surrogate countries they're working with. We stop that. And then we stop on the governmental national level the ability for them to trade. So, now, is that going to stop the Israelis at this point? Probably not, because it's estimated that this whole process takes between 1 and 3 years. If it were done right, it has not been done right. It has been done wrong by every administration, including the president. They won't take the steps necessary to do it. There's all kinds of reasons why that they won't. Okay, so the bottom line here is that if we're being creative, we've got to create this kind of force. But it's too late to stop the bombing. So we're not going to be able to stop that. If we do stop the bombing, they will get a nuclear device, a number of them, and they will create hell on Earth. And our president, the next time he gives a speech about how we're going to intervene and they won't get a bomb, maybe he'll be a victim of what they're going to do. You've got to understand, these people are not going to just sit there with atomic weapons and not give them to some of their surrogates to come to America, come to the United States, to set them off. Why do I know that? Because they said so. And if you don't want to believe them, then I guess you could say, oh, they're just kidding. They're not going to do that. They're going to take all those nuclear weapons, and they're just going to spit and polish them and, you know, put them on display, and everybody's going to say, oh, woe to the nuclear power of God. You know, they're going to pray to that God. But if you believe otherwise, then we've got to stop. Okay, so creation. Creation is the end product. Creation is the practical solution to so many problems that we have right now. And with the Israelis, they have to create a more impressive weapon than the few bunker-busting bombs they have from the United States. They only have like a few. And those aren't going to be enough to do in all the sites they have to hit. And the United States is refusing to give them any more at the present time. So they need to come up with a more effective weapon, and they have to do so very, very quickly. And that kind of weapon is going to need some kind of energy that they can accumulate by conventional means, rather than resorting to nuclear weapons, which they very, very likely have. So the best thing they can do would be to send a rocket with some kind of bomb, if you want to talk about it, or not, on its nose, to crash into these sites from outer space. They just shoot them up, but they have to have enough fuel to create the energy necessary to build it up into the mass of the rocket itself. That does the damage. It's called a kinetic energy weapon. And that's what is required. Not doing it from low altitudes near Earth or whatever. They've got to go all the way out, maybe hundreds of miles, maybe 1,000 miles in outer space, turn the darn thing around, and come flying back. We have the technology to do that. I don't know that the Israelis do. They may have to really, kick their butts in high gear and try to make something like that, because that's what you're going to need if you don't have a bunker-busting bomb. And even ours might not work, because they know what the specs are on them. So why not build the Iranians? Why not build something that's just a little stronger than the bomb is, and you're fine. Unless you use one of these kinetic weapons, which could be far more, far stronger than any bunker-busting bomb. That's just an example. There's other things you can do. You can kidnap all the scientists. I don't think killing them is really the way to go. I realize that scares the scientists who remain. But you know what? I would kidnap them. I'd take them out of the country. And kind of like hold them in some place where they, you know, you might be able to teach them a thing or two. Maybe we can send them to Gitmo, you know? I'm sure they'd get along with all the extremists over there. You know, and some of these guys may want that. They would prefer, possibly, to be kidnapped, especially if they can get the families with them. But anyway, again, creation. Being creative is a way of exploring avoiding a circumstance in which it seems as though there is no solutions other than, you know, some kind of mutually assured destruction, which nobody really wants that. But so there are ways, there are things that we can be doing. Seriously, we can be doing these things, and it would be behoove us to consider being creative. And now, of course, I started off this segment now talking about all these other ways of things in creation that would be more of a collective effort. But still, on an individual basis, each individual can be creating new ways of being enlightening. You might say, well, how is it enlightening to drop bombs on people? Well, because it eventually reveals the evil, which is the darkness. Assuming the bombs hit things that are really terrible, if they were in a lot of these circumstances. And when people become more aware of evil, that's enlightening. That's how. Just the act of setting off the bomb or even destroying the facility will not necessarily do that. But over time, by destroying the facility, we stop the possibility of the spread of evil and war. And at the same time, we expose it, which may be even more important, really. Okay, I thought maybe we'll take a little bit of a break right now, just for a few minutes. If you haven't tried 5-Chi Jizik, you should, if you have any pain. How well does it work? It works great. Does it work for everybody? No. Who doesn't it work for? People who knowingly are destroying their senses and bodies, particularly the physical body, the electromagnetic or etheric part of it as well. And those people, knowing doing it, creates a lot of kinds of energy in the system that's called negative chi. That's of a peculiar kind. When we think about chi energy, we know from prior programs that chi only is a life energy, which is what its name is, when it is moving. If you confine it, it becomes a negative energy, and it will make you ill and eventually kill you. It can kill you by decreasing your senses, so you can have terrible accidents as well. So that's inclusive within this concept. All right. So chi is that energy. And Fai Chi, by the way, we spell chi in the Chinese spelling, which is QI. So people say, well, how do you spell that? Phy. QI, Jizik. Okay, so when we're dealing with those kinds of energies that are brought about by a person's conscious decision to do a lot of negative things, including self-destruction, by the way, such as smokers might do, or people who are into serious drug addictions and things like that. That sort of thing can be very destructive because the chi that they create, the negative chi that they create, is much more potent. It can lead to cancers. It can lead to many debilitating kinds of diseases. And it is highly destructive to the senses. So it's a big deal. And if you have that nature to yourself, Fai Chi Jizik is going to be of limited value, if any. Because you might have to take so much of it for so long to even undo the forces in a few centers, you may not even notice that it's working. And, again, people who have the problems we're talking about aren't going to necessarily stop them. So that's the problem. They continue with them and they say, well, am I getting better? All right, yeah, you will get better. Who else may not benefit from 5-Chi? Well, people who have taken a lot of pain pills, a lot of pain drugs, and have some addiction to them as well as they've lost their effectiveness, that's a sign that they have damaged the divinic energies that send the pain signals. And the divinic energy, when they get damaged, oftentimes exaggerate the pain. So the reason the 5-Chi Jizik won't work necessarily is because there's an exaggeration of the real levels of pain due to the way that the drugs that we ingested and other lifestyle issues have adversely affected the divinic energies, which are part of the, we'll call it, etheric nervous system. And so those people may have trouble getting relief, too. hope that makes some sense to you. But the most people, like probably in the 80-90% range, could have some benefit, and for sure 70% or better of the population have a good deal of benefit by taking 5-HT-Gzm. So there's a good reason to be quitting smoking, quitting using drugs, including alcohol, if you're going to want to get rid of some of your pains, virtually all of them. The more you live that way, the more 5-HT-Gzm will work for you. And the less you do, unfortunately, the less it might. Now, does a guarantee that we saw with it include people who may have these issues? Yes. So we're saying, yeah, it might not work as well for someone who's, you know, boozing it up and smoking and whatever, but we're still going to give them the opportunity to try it, and if it didn't work, they get, still get their money back for the bottle, right? Now, that's not too bad of a deal. Come on, we're not able to do this if a lot of people take us up on it because we put it out of business. But we're able to do it because we think that most people that really are going to be attracted to and even use this product already have a higher consciousness in some respects. And so the chances of them screwing up the whole thing by doing some other things that are really negative to themselves, less. So there's a better chance it'll work. You can get it at buygzik.com. Buygzik.com. And if you want to call, you can talk to somebody about buying it at 602-431-5762. That's 602-431-5762. Buygzik, spelled PHYQI-GESIC. Try it out. I think you'll find it to be really as good as I said. Okay, so now let's get back to the show, even though that was like another piece of the show in its own sense, right? Talking about helpful things, and it's good. All right, the grace of God and the light at the end of the tunnel. We have to be more creative in order to overcome our fear, to allow us to be less illusioned and live our life in ways in which we become convinced that consciousness exists after death, and then it's no longer a concern that we will die. Nobody really is that wed to their bodies, and I'll tell you why. The longer you live, the more the body depreciates and fails. If people live a long life, and they're dying because their body is going, whatever certain reasons there are, they don't mind that much. They're already living such a decreased life in terms of ability, with so many pains and fatigue and medical difficulties, that the death of the body is not as big a deal to them as is death of consciousness, but a huge deal to those that are who are convinced that their consciousness moves on, particularly if you understand the astral world and all the other stuff in metaphysics, it's not that bad a deal. They just say, okay, so it's like putting on new clothes, a suit, time. And you're going to go on and live in one of these seven minor dimensions of the astral world, and you're going to have a pretty decent life there with more meaning and greater levels and significant amounts of the grace of God that may be completely lacking while you're physically alive. So you've got all this coming about. You've got really a great opportunity, and you're able to see it for what it is. You say, yep, this is what it's about. I'm going to the astral world. You can picture that. You can see it in your mind. I'm going to meet a bunch of other people of like mind, and we're going to work together in a more service-related way. That sounds like a great deal, right? And the most important part of all this is the grace of God, because your consciousness is going to grow just from the fact you're now living in a place where the quantum constant is, you know, hundreds of thousands of times greater, and it's a different world completely. Very different. All right, so that's a good thing. Those are the we'll say the promises of life after death. Consciousness goes on. Now, let's talk about the practical side of some of these things in terms of, like, some people. I had a friend of mine who was at a talk I was giving, and she asked, what's going to happen to my dogs? What happens when a dog dies? Well, the more the dog is loved, and the more the dog loves back, and the more consciousness it is developed by the constant interaction between human beings and itself, its consciousness is growing, and no part of that consciousness will ever die. If it has enough consciousness to keep itself alive beyond approximately what is called the sixth astral subworld, it's going to be in great shape, because even at the fifth subworld level, it will retain most of its beingness, and it will have some memory of its future life. Not all dogs, this is true for ones that are abused, and ones that are living with people who have low consciousness, may not achieve this, but it's possible. And why is that true? Why? What's going on in the seventh and sixth subworld, besides the eighth sphere, that is so problematic for animals? Well, first of all, if an animal dies, or when an animal dies, and goes to the sixth or seventh subworlds, it's treated with more as an object, and it's very little love. That means it probably was treated that way while it was physically alive as well. And it is facing all kinds of, we'll say, abusive issues. Some people actually train animals to be aggressive in those realms. There also are monsters that try to have influence over animal populations. There are people who try to do the same. It's a kind of a very negative place to hang out, much less live. And for the dogs and cats and whatever other pets, they all need to be able to grow and to be more loving than they were while they were physically alive. And in order for that to happen, they're going to need to have contact with people who live on higher spheres, higher dimensions of time and space in the astral world. And usually you find them living like in the fifth or fourth astral subworld. And when you're living in that circumstance, then the animal, surprisingly, becomes very conscious, even if it was while it was physically alive, not very conscious. And a lot of good can come out of it, seriously. A lot of good can. And so it's not such a bad thing, really, you know, that they can be brought to that level, so to speak. Even though they may have started in the sixth level, a lot of them end up in the fifth. Alright, so then what can we say about the consciousness issue, and how does the grace of God get into this? Well, already these animals have been mistreated by human beings, and so there's a direct connection going on when they are failing. And so we then have the responsibility to bring them out of it, and some people do. Sometimes that's the very nature of the relationship to God. It is significant that there's a whole slew of animals that may want to go on and live their life in other dimensions in a more full and complete fashion, but at the same time, they also have to take a greater level of responsibility in these higher realms that they're going to live in, and they have to be equally more loving. Well, this is no simple thing, and it's hard for human beings to do this. Now we're expecting our animals to go ahead and succeed, but that doesn't always work. So say the opportunity is there. Most of the time, the people in the fifth and fourth subworlds are more than pleased to adopt any animals that can stay awake and conscious in their dimension. They won't adopt animals that don't, because you can't relate to them, and they constantly disappear and go to the lower dimensions. And so this is an impossible thing that we can all cure and remedy all these animals. You can't do it. All right, so the animals in the fifth and higher subworlds of the astral world live expanded lives. In the fifth subworld, they might live a few years to 5 or 10. It depends on what kind of animal we're out to. And when we get to higher levels, when we get to the fourth and the third, well, that's a whole different ballgame. You don't have very selfish animals, but you have very loving animals. And so the relationship between the animal and the people is different. And there's a better chance for those animals to end up there. So it is something to consider. It's something to think about, that this is not as simple as it may seem. And, okay, what happens eventually is the animal's astral body dies, and the animal then moves on to live in the monastic realm. And we had one person here who at times may not have recognized this concept component. It's really interesting that when we look at how we think of animals and the way they really are, we're usually thinking less of the animal than it really is, particularly when it's an animal that is a close pet, loved and cared for by people. All right, so the eventual outcome of this, the grace of God, so to speak, is the animals that go to the fifth subworld oftentimes end up living in the fourth in a short time, and the fourth subworld sometimes they end up living in the third. The big deal is if an animal can make it to the spiritual two subworlds, the second and first subworlds, because there the animal actually experiences much more of being human than being an animal. And they have similar kinds of consciousness and choices to a young, and especially a child, or early adolescent human. And that's not too bad. That's very good compared to what you would expect out of any kind of animal. And in so doing, at the same time, they are filled with God's grace because they are doing so many good things. They're enlightened by the process, and they're in these higher spheres. So a lot of good things do happen when you have that kind of thing going. Now, eventually animals die from the astral world, and most do not have a mental life. The few that have mental lives are the ones that stayed most of the time in the second and first subworld, and or first subworld. Very, very few of the animals that were on the third subworld that usually left that subworld just before death, they may also end up with some small amount of mental life, usually not any higher than the subworld, no fourth subworld at all in the middle sense. And so these animals have all this consciousness that remains in them. And when they get to the middle world, that consciousness either develops some kind of animal life there, or it goes on to become part of the group soul, but with a segregated part of the group soul oftentimes that has several individualizing animals connected to it. And it then causes the animals to reincarnate again and again and again, with a lot more understanding and knowledge than some animals would naturally have. It's a state in which the animal now has exceeded what it was before, because the collective consciousness of the groove soul is brought together on an average of all the animals that are individualizing. And so these animals benefit from all the other pets that are well treated by human beings. And so they aren't just on their own, but they have a lot of their own individual consciousness, and borrowed from that is the consciousness of all the other animals that are, in a more individual sense, having some individuality. And this individuality enhances each lifetime. More and more individuality means more and more creativity. More creativity means less fear of the fact that they are conscious and possibly conscious of death. And so they don't have fear of death. They don't have fear of death in the physical body, just the way human beings do. They are mimicking or resembling the experiences that some human beings have, but there's slight differences in the way that it comes about, which is what I just described to you. And when you put it all together, it's just a wondrous thing, because it means the more an animal is loved and the more it returns love, the more it is. It's a great pet and has a terrific ability to be creative, not just intelligent, but creative. It actually uses that intelligence for creativity. Then you can expect that animal to gain in consciousness and to become less afraid of death. An animal that is less afraid of death has a more meaningful life and is usually, in the long run, better behaved with people. In addition, that same animal goes on and collectively grows in the experience, even borrowing some of the growth that other animals similar to it are doing. This is a terrific system, one where the love of God and the grace of God is just overwhelming because it works so well. You can see how upside down the system would be to believe in no God, or believe in a God that doesn't grant and want us to be conscious beyond the death of the body. That would be a bizarre God. That would be a place where life would have virtually no meaning. And so with death, the whole thing would make no sense. It would be a kind of world that, well, I don't know, I wouldn't want to live there. Now, animals also, as they advance in consciousness, share some of their creativity and their loss of fear of death with humans. Animals can be very helpful in helping humans who are facing death to overcome death if they themselves have been loved and have high individuality. They could truly then be service animals, like service dogs. We're putting a dog that we have through this same kind of thing where it's going to become a service dog. And one of the ways we foresee it being of service is to breed the dog as it grows more consciousness into contact with people who may have a fear of death because they're in a hospice site. And, and we can even do it in their homes because hospices sometimes have people that don't live in the hospice, they just help them in the house. But the animal can bring about a change in the fear level of the dying person, who might not be dead in a minute or two, but it may be in a month or two, can help that person to reconcile its own death because the animal has become so creative that it has overcome some of the fear of death itself. And to a level at which the person can experience this on a truly astral or emotional level. That could be a great service that animal is supplying, and so to the people who are bringing the animal up and helping it. Usually they have to be a little mature, closer to maybe, let's say, beyond the puppy stage. They have to be, a little more mature. They have to have developed this fearless side and to be creative and shown it without question. It's not that hard to evaluate. It may be hard for people to realize what it is they're supposed to evaluate, but it's not that hard to evaluate. And you could determine it fairly readily for most animals. This is a great possibility. And I think you can see how this could all work towards the good. Consciousness doesn't die. It just moves on, and through the grace of God, grows in most cases as well. Wow. Even in dogs and cats. And who knows what else? Chickens, maybe. Who knows? I don't know if chickens are very conscious, per se. But the point is that this is the way it works. And hopefully, in my explanation of it, it's making more sense than in the shows that I've done earlier in this subject, where I didn't spend the time in explaining how these things work on a practical side as well. All right, so then what happens to the human? The human is going on, through the grace of God, is gaining in consciousness. But the human is also losing bodies and senses. So it can't serve at the same level it would have served if it was physically alive. That's all true. However, I can tell you from experience that people in the mental world spend the first couple hundred years or more of their time getting over their fear of loss of consciousness and the fear of ending of consciousness as well. It's only when they become creative enough to correct the problems that they didn't correct through the past of their existing life and maybe some other ones that stuck out as being really bad ones. Once they get to the point where they are creative enough to change all that, what's in the Akashic experience, or record some people call it, then those folks truly awaken to the consciousness of others around them, which is much more complete and full. And they can interrelate together, and they can plan and cooperate together to create more and more virtue. Remember, the ultimate creation is the creation of virtue, and that's what we're really talking about when I say creation. I'm not talking about creating bad things and destructive things. I'm talking about creating things that are liberating and good. Remember, I have explained about evil. If evil is being destructive, then you can destroy it. Remember that, in terms of the Iranian thing. Okay, so now we've got this, we've got the basis here, so we can see that in the monastic world, it takes a few hundred years for a lot of people to get over the amount of egotism and arrogance they have about certain circumstances and situations, so that they are becoming more creative and less fearful. Now, awakening in the mental world is different than awakening in the astral. In the astral world, you awaken first and then sometimes diminish over time your senses. In the mental world, you awaken after you have overcome a good part of your illusion, and then the remaining sense that you have, you use to be of service to others around you in that world. It's a kind of a very different philosophy or way of life, because the people there are so much more conscious. They get some of the stuff that we're talking about. They get it. Not all of them. They get it. All right. So then the process is, as I put it, going back to your soul. Why is it that people don't just keep going with this raising or elevating their consciousness and just make themselves back into their soul? And there's a very good reason for it. And that is that this, again, is based upon creation, not based upon just being good. Yes, the creation needs to be virtuous creation, but it still has to be creation. And many people forget that, especially in the mental world, after they've spent so much time trying to overcome their illusions, they think that that's it. Done. It isn't. What you need to do is cultivate the experience of creation and cultivate it in ways in which you're co-creating with others, as you all reflect and understand God to be as well. God can be there with you. So it's a kind of a strange circumstance that now we're talking about creation in the purely mental sense, remember that that's what's left, there's no more astral or physical energy, and creation in that sense can be profound. But at the same time, as you create these things, you've got to be expanding your consciousness, and that comes from sharing and giving those creations to others as a soul would, and living for the first time the life of a soul instead of the life of a human being. Even though your soul exists in another realm, the higher mental world, you're in the lower mental world, and you're still living a life more as a soul because you recognize the sharing that's necessary to develop closer to becoming your soul instead of, you know, just wasting it, so to speak. You're in a position now, at this stage, where the grace of God is the grace of sharing life as close as possible in the lower mental world and the soul. So as your life becomes more and more embedded in soul-like experiences, you now have the awareness of consciousness, of fear or death, and all that gone. And instead, each moment is a way of using up the correct things in you to create a person now who is going to be more soul-like than the personality. The balance tips towards the end of lower mental life. And some people actually experience for a short time, in service oftentimes to others in the astral world, the life of a third and even fourth level of initiate at times. That's a pretty big deal. And so this is a huge change in the creation issue. Because these people become super creative, but in a mental sense now. They're not physically here building things. They're mentally creating formulas and understanding how to create those things for the future. But they affect the whole mental world when they create these great inventions, so it's a good thing. Can they carry through any of these things in a later life? Yes, they can. Some of the creations that they think about and try to put in helpful action with other beings, other people, can be carried over into the next lifetime. And that's why they might have such an affinity for one kind of thing over another, etc., because of this great challenge. Wow. So, souls are amazing things, and you're kind of a mini-soul, you're kind of a part-soul when you're in the last lifetime of getting over your fears, and getting over your fear particularly of being creative. And now, life takes on this whole greater meaning, and it's a pretty amazing thing, because now you can say to yourself, wow, I am truly interacting with others on a soul level. It may have been a thought, it may have been a desire that you've had for several lifetimes, but you didn't get to the point where you could actually go to the higher lifetime, life ways of living. And so now you are, you're in this soul vein, and you're creating all this virtue, and you're godlike in some respects. And the world has a huge amount more meaning to it. Wow. This is a great thing. Again, it can influence your next lifetime. It doesn't necessarily have to or will. But many human souls want to go back to being the soul in full consciousness. It wants to proceed in the same vernacular, the same general context, so that you will use all of this positive, tremendous virtue that you created in the past lifetime. You will not lose consciousness. You don't lose it. You gain it. And you say, well, but you don't gain it when you go down to being physical again. You start all over. That's not true. It's still a choice. And some people have built up so much virtue, so much spirit within them in the mental world, both lower and then later higher. And when you do reincarnate, they may not do that great right at the very beginning, But every time they meet with someone who is an inventor, there's more that comes together, and they are able to process information really faster, too. And the results are of a magnitude that's phenomenal for the next lifetime. It won't necessarily be all conscious. No, they're not going to remember everything that happened in the mental world because, and this may be a misunderstanding some people have, consciousness is not memory. Consciousness is not memory. Consciousness is the ability to take knowledge and apply it to many different things. You don't have to have direct memory of having done that before. You have enough consciousness to replicate it and do it whenever it's needed. Memory is a more mental function, but it is also related to each of the brains and contact with the storage system. So memory comes through the storage element of the brain, and it's the building of these memories into new ways of manipulating and using knowledge that some people think is the most important part of existence. But consciousness is the ability to take any knowledge and apply it to bigger and bigger situations. Totally different thing. It's a much more important element. Consciousness builds itself. Memory can help and improve usually the personality. And sometimes the personality's responses to and from its own soul. Those are not the same things, I think. All right. So, after the mental world, a person in the lower mental world, we become soul-like. And then we join our soul in full consciousness. Once we, and now some people say, well, didn't you say that, hey, in the lower mental world, some people fall asleep and they don't. Yeah, okay. So for a brief period, you might fall asleep, but you join your soul in full consciousness eventually. And you're the soul. You and the soul are one. And the rest of it was the period of time when you were limited from being a soul by your own mistakes and illusions and by the surrounding forces. You recognize that as a soul, and you say, well, let's try to see if we can do better this next time. And the soul is going to work with others that it worked with in the lower mental world, as a piece of it, remaining human, try to create virtue there. And that's going to be part of its plan to work together with these other beings because they're all going to be part of a, we'll say, a collective unit for creating virtue in the world. Do they remember each other? No. But are they conscious of each other? Yes. Do they need to have some awareness of each other before they're conscious of each other? Not necessarily. But if you have both, you can use either with much greater fortitude and the ability to be expressive in your creativity. That's it. See how it works? Your creativity is expanded by all the people that you came in contact with in the lower mental world while you were serving with them after you've dealt with your own Akashic issues and karma beforehand. And now you get all this wow, amazing stuff going on to you. And that's well worth the whole experience, including sometimes the nastiness of living in very forceful environments like in the physical world. Wow. I mean, that is pretty fascinating. All right. So we reach a point, humans reach a point where they do start remembering. When you remember 60% of a lifetime, you have a good recall of the prior life. And you can use that 60% to then be of service to others. And you can help others that you may be karmically connected to through both the last lower mental plane life that you had and the addition of each of you having the grace of God from that. So that when you come back into the next life, if you've really done great things, you lose nothing, you just gain. And maybe you can make the next physical life a super creative one that serves others that deals with maybe some levels of evil. Sometimes it'll be forced upon you if you're in that position, but evil wants to stop folks like that. And sometimes you can then work together with the same folks to provide yourself with a platform for inevitable great co-creation together. Wow. That's a terrific thing. It really is a terrific thing. This is the promise of God, and this is the last of the, we'll say, allegorical lights at the end of the tunnel. The last light at the end of the tunnel is the next life in the physical world for someone who has really availed themselves to all the grace of God and to all the growing of consciousness with no loss of consciousness ever, because that's the illusion, and comes into the next life unafraid of death or to create, and has about 60% or so of events connected together, which is the only way you sustain memory, and therefore has some memory of prior lives, and therefore has virtually no fear of death, no concern about the things that most people have concerns about in terms of does God exist, or and what is God like, and what is the meaning of life in this respect, and on and on and on, because you can remember and you have consciousness and sense that match these higher levels that most people can attain. Wow. Tell me, this isn't exciting. I mean, it really is a great thing. Compared to the religious beliefs of some and to the general beliefs of others, like who aren't religious or atheists, this is such a better system. And if you can think it, then God would have created it, rather than a system where people are going to suffer the fear of death through each lifetime, or through the present lifetime, creating a terrible mockery of the love of God and the grace of God. It's the antithesis of the grace of God to believe that way. Remember that. Hopefully you won't do it. Hopefully you will pursue a life of real virtue, a life where you have the most amount of light created. Virtue must be created. If you read Life of Being, you know that it says it over and over and over and over again. I still have people saying to me, tell me how I can be virtuous. You gotta create it. Nobody can tell you how, because then they'd be taking the creation part away. Can you co-create together with others and God? Sure. But your job in creation cannot be a puppet show. It can't be some unbelievable stealing from some book or person or whatever. It needs to truly be uniquely your higher self showing itself as a soul here in this world, as a great being who is doing wonderful and great things. Hopefully tonight we've covered the grace of God and the light at the end of the tunnel, and a whole bunch more about consciousness and how the proof that there is grace, the proof that there is light, is that there is creativity and consciousness that you can figure out for yourself through the things I told you about earlier in the show. So now you've got the tools to do the job. Well, until next week, I hope you're hearing me, Eric. We're about to sign off. This has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.